The Australian Presbyterian Bible Church, January the 15th, 2017. The focus, Christ, without compromise. The Bible, without qualification, the only authorized written word from God to man. Sermon today, the United Flesh Company Propriety Limited. The United Flesh Company Propriety Limited. The curse, the glory, and the cure. We look, first of all, as a text that will have a underlying impact here to the events which we plan to look at in Romans 8, 5 to 6. Now listen to the ears of the heart here. For those who live according to the flesh, that means an independent mind, heart, and body. What is just flesh, what is cut off from its creator, that's flesh in this setting. For those who live according to the flesh, set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Are you spiritually minded? Do you have in these things the life and the peace which comes from the sin-satisfying sacrifice of the Savior? Do you have the power which comes from the resurrected Lord, body itself, denying all rotting and corruption? As we look at parts of the Old Testament in the dramatic circumstances of Israel, we will get, I should say, plenty of illustrations, exhortations, and grounds for reflection. So let's move to Exodus. Exodus 17. The United Flesh Company, Propriety Limited. It has a number of people holding it, and it's very limited, but it's the United Flesh Company. Safety in numbers. If everybody's in hospital groaning with pain, don't worry about it. You're all together. Wonderful, isn't it? Not really. Try it out and see if you must. We look then at Exodus 17:7. There had been a tiff, an estrangement, an upset, a drama amongst the people with their leader Moses, who's taken them successfully out of what was then the major world power, Egypt, right under the noses of the army, who were left drowned as a satisfactory residue for their escape to be successful. So in Exodus 17, after this difficulty, what was the difficulty about? Well, it certainly wasn't about the escape as such. There was a shortage of water, with a huge number of people in the desert. That is scarcely surprising. There was no water for the people to drink. Now, if you don't have water and you want somebody to drink, there's several ways you can go about it. You can buy some, if there's a shop. You can find some, if you know where. Or you can ask someone in authority, if you have reason to believe, that he has the answer. You can say, excuse me, I'm short of water. I'm so made that if I don't get some soon, I'm sorry, but I may become faint. I wonder if you would be willing to oblige my very ardent need. Great, lovely, courteous. But that's not quite what happened. The people contended with Moses. They were roused. They're ready for an upset. They're willing to have a to-do. Give us water that we may drink. Now, there are some people who would be inclined not to do so because they don't like being addressed that way, but still, you have a heart and somebody needs a drink. Well, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? The people thirsted for water and they complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt? All right. So they're brought out of slavery in the heat, building bricks and whatever was desired of them, slaves. And now because for the moment they're short of water, Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt? They say with their best confrontational episode. To kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst. Now, look at that. It implies that Moses had a purpose. Yep. The purpose was to bring the people out of Egypt, not out of slavery, no. Out of the comforts of Egypt. And then to slay them with water. I would suggest that's rather a hostile imputation. I suggest that lots of the politics I hear in Australia are very similar. You hear people accusing some dead, all he wants. You hear these quarrelsome, contentious, confrontational, morally ruinous, incredibly adjectivally unpleasant statements, commanding demands from small gods, you would think, as they attack each other, sour grapes, sour thoughts, sour attributions, sad estimates of the situation, sad, contentious. Why not govern? And start with yourself. Exodus 17. It went on. I'm trying to bring out the fact that these are not the only people that make the same mistakes. So Moses called the place where all that happened. In fact, he had to say to the Lord, they're almost ready to stone me, when he spoke to the Lord about it. And there's another lesson. When you have a trouble, however urgent it may be, seek to speak to the Lord about it and get the answer. And if you don't believe it, well, why talk of faith? And so Moses was told what to do. And so we come to the interrogation and intervention aspect of the matter. Interrogation and intervention. Moses was told precisely what to do. Verse 5 of chapter 17 of Exodus. What shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders, you see. Do it publicly. Don't be afraid. Have faith. And you shall strike the rock and the water will come out of it that the people may drink. So take in your hand the rod. So first of all, go, take elders, take your rod. The one that you smote the waters with when the children of Israel went through and the rest were drowned after the waters came back. Take that rod. Don't forget the things of the past. Don't forget that with the rod in your life, and all of you who are Christians will know the Lord's interventions. Take the same rod. Take the same faith. Go, not forgetting all that's been done in the past. Take the implements of prayer and faith. Go. Take the elders with you. And then strike the rock. And the part I like is verse 6. And Moses did so. Oh, how lovely. And Moses did so. Instead of about what would have happened if only the opposition, if only this person, if only that idea, if only. But instead of that, Moses did so. So here we see a number of features of the manner of Moses, M-A-N-N-E-R, the manner, the method, the way, the style of Moses. And Moses did so. So the provisions were made. Water will come out of it and the people will drink. And that's what happened. And Moses did so and the Lord did so. Now we come to the interesting point that I have in mind. Moses gave a name to that particular area where the water came out, and it wasn't Water Lake or anything like that. It was contention, and tested. There were two things notable to him. There was contest, confrontation, and contention. There was not a nice spirit of cooperation, understanding, and goodwill. And there was testing. As I've been watching some of the tennis recently, and we have a lot of tennis in Australia in January, and I sometimes can watch it, I have been thinking to myself more and more, when you see this particular man put up a high volley and somebody else attempts to meet it and doesn't quite make it and so forth, and each person puts forth some remarkable shot and does slash does not get a remarkable return, each one of these is a test. Don't think too much about misfortune. There will be little things which will tend to even out. Think rather of, what has he got? He must use that to meet what is thrown at him. Did he succeed in doing it? What has the person who was throwing it at him got? Is he succeeding in throwing it at him in such a way that what the other person has got cannot be successfully used? Now, of course, there are all sorts of tempers and wills and psychological and emotional and other elements. But in the end, if you've got an emotional deficiency, that's one of the things that you have. Or put differently, if you don't have emotional strength, that's one of the things you don't have and therefore you can't use. So, thinking then of the idea of testing. So this was testing and strife. So we've looked at the way in which Moses met it as an example. And we come on now to the next phase in this matter. Now I'd like to go back now to Exodus 14, to see some of the earlier testings which lead up to a climax in the end. As they all mount together like the end of a tennis set, there is a result. Now, in Exodus 14, you see quite a number of tests. Things which interrogate, as in Exodus 17, Moses called that place testing and confrontation because they people had said, is the Lord among us or not? That's why it got that name. Don't let me leave that out. Is the Lord among us or not? And therefore the place was called that. The nature of the response was quizzical. Confrontationally almost ironic. Demanding. Commanding. Is the Lord among us or not? How often people... Well, if he's not going to... I don't believe in a God who... Oh, don't you? How interesting. What if a sergeant comes up to a colonel and says, I don't believe in a colonel who... Now, he might, of course, be quite right, but when it comes to God, you're not going to be quite right. Don't make your faith dependent on the misery of your emotional deficits. Let your faith depend on the fact that nothing didn't create, God did. The world doesn't continue outside the rubbish bin. By justice to our remarkable morals, but by an expression of a remarkable and amazing mercy where God has gone so far as to cover the case, not by getting water out of rock, very understandable, it's still a miracle for the case at the time, but by getting pardon and peace out of profundity of sin. Is the Lord among us or not? I suggest you put that on the lapel of your coat with a cross over it. That would give you a double symbolism. And so we go back to Exodus 14 to see any more confrontations. Is the Lord among us or not? Attitudes. So here they are proceeding out of Egypt. They are about to have a deliverance. Let's look at what they showed like a tennis player at the confrontation. Verse 13, and Moses said to the people, don't be afraid, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will see again no more forever. Now, that was a very good reply. Why? We've been talking about nasty remarks, hideous, odious, confrontational rorts that people can readily practice against each other, as though words had no meaning. But listen to this. Just listen to the children of Israel on the way out with Moses in verse 11 of Exodus 14. Listen with the ears of your heart. What do they say? Because there were no... Excuse me. It really has a funny side. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Well, that's one of the most barbed remarks I've ever heard. Were you looking around Egypt while we were slaving away and saying, oh, well, these people have got to die. They can die in Egypt. Although I don't like to look at the place. It's not really fit for a grave. I'll take them out somewhere else so they can die in the desert. Think of it. Think of what's being said and suggested about Moses. Because there were no graves in Egypt. One thing you usually find a ready place for is a grave. Have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Now I have every sympathy with the Egyptians, but that isn't the way to handle a test. I feel the same when they bash their rackets. They're much the same in essence. Is not this the word that we were told you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? See, we told you so. When we were there, we say, we don't want to come out. Leave us alone. We're quite happy to be slaves. We said that, didn't we? See, I told you so. We said all this. But no. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. You can just imagine a cartoonist trying to create a face for that. And the answers we've seen, look at the piece of this. Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. Like Christ saying to the man about when he would be, when you come into your kingdom, and he says, today! That was the answer to that question. And here, for the Egyptians whom you see today, you will see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace. Which he will accomplish for you when, verse 13? Today. And so we're beginning to be introduced to interrogation and intervention. Is the Lord among us or not? Interrogation and intervention. The Lord provided the water. The Lord divided the water. He acted both ways. But before we get to the division of the water, which is one of the Lord's responses, the interventions before the interrogations are finished, 19 of Exodus 14. I always love this. The angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Well, someone's got a gun leveled at you from 20 yards off, but he can't quite make out your image. He hopes you haven't moved. It'd be quite nice for it to be dark all that night until you manage to escape. So the Lord Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back. So there we have, first of all, the cloud intervention, then the sea intervention. And so the children of Israel go back, and then the sea returns. And the waters that were like a wall are now like a burial site. The Lord has delivered them not only from the immediate context of confrontation, but has taken them, despite their confrontational attitude towards him, not to mention his servant Moses, the Lord has taken them away from the army by taking the army away from the earth, except for their bodies, which don't possess life. And so we have that intervention in Exodus 14. Followed by a wonderful song of delight. We turn to Exodus 16. verse 3. Well, they're journeying, chapter 16, verse 1, from Elim, and they come to the wilderness of Sin, perhaps named in more than one way, which is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Notice how quickly all this is happening. They're nowhere near 40 years, they're just a couple of months, something like that. Then the whole congregation of Israel complained, here we go, against Moses and Aaron this time. They said, oh, verse 3 of chapter 16 of Exodus, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord, mortician in Egypt, in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill. Oh, this whole assembly was hungry. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, and I may test whether they will walk in my law or not. Don't forget, you are tested. What is the use of losing your temper? What good does it do? Whether your temper say things like, why didn't you bury us in Egypt? Or any other witticism which may come to your wandering will and turgid spirit, because such things can happen. And I believe that allowing oneself this foolish riposte, this garrulous assault on other people, sometimes it's worthy, I agree. But very often it isn't. That can lead to depression. You explode. You say things which are manifestly, monumentally wrong, daringly fastidious with your feelings and oblivious to the feelings and facts for the other. Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. You brought us to kill her. Really? Do you really believe that? You've got evidence for that? There have been times when you've been interrogating and the Lord didn't answer. Could you tell us last time that happened? Thank you. You can't remember it? It reminds me of the time when a young interviewer went to see Professor Dawkins in England and said, could you tell us a time where you can actually see evolution happening? And he did this a few times and then he gave no answer whatsoever to the point. And so here, can you tell any time when we failed, where there was no answer to your problem? No. Oh, well, why do you say such things? I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people go out and gather a certain quota. Now, not only did they have bread from heaven, verse 12, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, both. But now, a thing known as discipline, what seems to be hated by many psychologists who help to create, by lack of due discipline, help to create wandering spirits who suddenly hit reality as they've never seen it before, having been looked after like a packet of marshmallows on a hot day in a kid's pocket. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? It was manna. This is another manna, M-A-N-N-A, and it means what? So, what's this? What? That was the manna. What in the world is this? Well, it fed them. And so, it was associated with discipline. Before the day of rest, get two lots. So you won't have to gather it in the day of rest. So when they did that, none of it went off overnight. And when some people went to see if they gathered some more on the day of rest, it did go off. So God put down the idea of discipline. You were created by the God who for 6 days, the term used in the same sense as in the rest of the book in general, and he then rested. You were instructed to do the same, And you are re-instructed, and your food supply will mirror that fact. In life there are realities. There are facts. There are facts. And there are tendencies such as power corrupts, speaking of man, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Look at Stalin. Will Putin follow? Look at Mao. How many millions between them? 40? 50? Dead? Ponder that. So we have to face the fact that there is discipline, and discipline is surat. How much discipline? I'm simply staggered for my part. I'm wheeled into this universe, or not literally wheeled, but as if I've been wheeled. And I'm like an aircraft. I can fly, I can land, I can take off slowly, I can stay above this place or that place, I can travel, I can think, which it can't. I can resolve, I can choose, I can have values, I can look at facts, I can reason, I can know what's what, I can follow the obvious line of logic. Logic didn't invent itself out of nothing or chance, obviously. It's here, so God invented it. Someone logical invented it, of course. I can do all this. I can learn from the God who made my incredibly fantastic body. You read about this very much in the fourth edition of Genetic Entropy, which has become a very remarkable additive to the exposure to the fact that God is and did create. By Professor Emeritus J.C. Sanford. Our genomes are decaying, and they are not advancing. He gives you all the mathematical stuff on that, and all the statistical stuff on that, and all the experimental stuff on that, and he shows how there is no answer whatsoever. It is a fact, and of course it is in terms of the second law of thermodynamics, which indicates that entropy will increase. That is, things will tend to deteriorate. I've never seen an Empire State Building build itself, but I have seen a mother with a child built through her, and she didn't even have to contribute any of the mathematics. So we are faced with facts, which mean discipline, because if you don't like reality, guess what? Reality, let me say it softly, may not like you. And since it's real, and your lease on life is, unless you find the Savior, limited, you'll be hurt. Maybe with boredom, maybe with self-condemnation, maybe with depression, maybe with hideous exaltation, maybe with murder on your mitts, you will be hurt. And that's nothing to how you will be hurt when you say, I'm good enough to get to heaven. Why, what a lovely fellow. We must really bring him in. He'd be so lovely to listen to in the long winter nights, if there were any. So we've been looking at the interrogations, and we've been looking at Exodus 14. And then we've been looking at further complaints. 16. The meat. The Sabbath lesson. We come up to 17, the water, and that's where we began. The water on the rock. Give us water, 17:2 of Exodus, that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? A good idea. Calm down. And so the rock is struck, the water comes, and they have a victory. So the Lord is being very gracious to them. And we then come up to Mount Sinai. And so in chapter 20 of Exodus, the famous Ten Commandments. See, more room for tests, more tests, different sorts of tests. Isn't that like life? Different sorts of tests. So Moses gets the Ten Commandments, and there we have it. Goes up into the mountain, Sinai and gets him and comes down. And of course, there's a slight problem. The golden calf, Exodus 32. Moses was a long while up there, and when he came down, he found that they were making for worship a golden calf, reminiscent of the gods of Egypt. A clear desire to go back. So Moses comes down, finds this, and the tablets of the law, which he'd so carefully been used to construct, are broken. They've broken the law, and this breaks the very basics of it. It will have to be done again. Let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. Exodus 32:9. God is testing Moses. When something gives you a negatistic opportunity, realize it as a test. Moses did also. Verse 11. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? And he pleads with the Lord, who suitably relents, and graciously and mercifully the thing proceeds. But it's mounting, isn't it? The tests aren't looking... I remember we used to have at Scots College when I was a student there, the words, I think it was in the minor exams, the student's work is -satisfactory. And you could have eminently satisfactory, very satisfactory, satisfactory, not quite satisfactory, unsatisfactory, or most unsatisfactory, and so forth, depending on the case. And so here, the work is seeming most unsatisfactory with this golden calf. But Moses once again stands firm and doesn't yield to the egotistic impulse which might have tried to attack him. So the people are carousing apparently, or having a fine old time going back to Egypt. Enough of all this! And Aaron explains it. And, well, the people gave me the metal, I put it in the fire, and that came out like this. One of the famous understatements. And so they were commanded to leave Sinai. And this is the beginning of the cumulative consequences of many confrontations. Consider that. The cumulative consequences of many confrontations. So we come along to Numbers 11. And here are the people are complaining. 11:1 of Numbers. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it. So there was a problem immediately. After the general problem was corrected, now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? Remember the fish, the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna. This what? Before our eyes. And the manna was like coriander seed, and its color like the color of delium. The people went about and gathered it round on millstones, beat it in the mortar, cooked it in the pans, and made cakes of it. Its taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. And he goes on to speak about the nature of this case. And Moses then says, verse 11 of chapter 11 of Numbers. Why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight? Oh, careful. That you have laid the burden of all these people on me. Did I conceive all these people? Oh, careful. Did I beget them? Well, it is tough, and he's doing a great job. And we can understand that you say to me, carry them in your bosom. I'm having to look after them in this fastidious fashion. As a guardian carries a nursing child to the lamb which you swore to their fathers. Where am I to get meat to give all these people? Don't you remember? for they weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. Well, quail had already been used. I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If I found favor in your sight. Now, that's a very saving added point. If you would be good enough to kill me here and now, I would recognize that as a mercy, as a divine intervention. I'm not trying to order you about, but that would seem preferable to me if I have found favor in your sight. Do let me see my wretchedness. Well, then the Lord shows him how to have elders and to depend on that. And then since the people start all this, verse 31 of chapter 11, a wind went out from the Lord and it brought quail from the sea. Now, there had already been quail for them to eat. Now it's coming again. They're complaining again, and left them fluttering near the camp about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on the other side. One of the most brutal complaints was, all right, so you've given us water, what about meat? So here, well, meat, is the meat the great thing, right? So the corral came fluttering. There it was, meat laid on! And the people stayed up all that day, all night, and all the next day, and gathered the quail, who gathered least in the, was so much. But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. Remember what we read in Romans 8 as the underlying verse, Romans 8. But those who live according to the flesh, the independent mind, body, and spirit, those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the spirit, the things of the spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. But before we go further, it's time to announce that this is just part one. And we'll be going on to look at the intention and the invention, to see how Christ has paid far more than any of us could pay, in order that instead of weeping at their own failure, the people have the divine God who comes to earth as a man weeping for their failure, and yet rejoicing because in the end, it all works out through the works of God. And then we'll come to differentiation, Lord willing. The wonders of when you work with the God who has worked things out on the cross and the resurrection, and using his power live in his kingdom, for those who are mindful of spiritual things walk in the spirit, and there is an entirely different life. Amen. Our Father, we thank thee for the goodness and the grace of God, for the confrontations and for the greater work of charity, for the tears the people shed because of the greater tears that Christ shed. How often will I have gathered you? And you wouldn't, but still in the end prevails when they're brought back. So for the individuals, O Lord, when they're brought back, when their hearts return, they return to the Lord and find in his love the mercy and peace which is paid for on behalf of all, and then is possessed by the individual through faith. Amen.